Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the lack of conflicting or paradoxical teachings in the Dhamma. This talk was presented at our Tuesday evening class in Frenchtown, New Jersey on November 3rd, 2015. I hope you find benefit from this talk. Peace.
So again, welcome everyone. I'm a little confused about the direction we're going to go tonight. The article, Paradox on the Dhamma, I was only going to read about the second half of it, and then maybe just have a group discussion about where we're at with our Dhamma practice and if there's any questions or answers. And then that led to the thought, do you feel that that would be helpful to have a class occasionally just on that, just having discussion about the Dhamma rather than a teaching? Does anybody have any feeling about that, one way or the other?
Mm-hmm.
I'm
not sure what you mean. But just
we can't have a class until 10 o'clock, so it's limited how much we can cover. But rather than spend the time reading a teaching and me talking about it, to have a class occasionally, it's just a group discussion about where we're at with our Dhamma practice and if there's any lingering questions that don't come up.
I like the teachings.
Okay. Well, and we do go around the room. I do that for a reason, to make sure that if there's any questions that you have a chance to have them answered. But okay.
I like the opportunity to be able to meditate in the group.
So we have a nice balance already. I don't need to go anywhere with that.
I mean, that's just me.
Except.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. I think tonight's going to be a rather short reading and talk, so maybe we'll have a little bit more time. I'm cutting out the first half of this, but maybe not. yeah, I think, would somebody else mind teaching this? The article is about confusion and paradoxical teachings, and it's left me rather confused and stuck in I'm stuck in a bit of a paradox. The article grew out of a quote that one of my online students sent me and wanted to know what do I think about this. And I guess I'll start there. The quote is from a rather well-known, world-renowned teacher in a certain tradition. He's deceased about 5 years now. I happen to have known him personally, and he's a wonderful man. Obviously, I don't agree with some of the things that he taught. So he made this quote, I think it was about 2 years before he died. So 2007, I guess, probably when he... Thus we arrive at the paradoxical truth of the Buddha way. The only possible free choice we can make is to choose to work for the freedom of all humankind, indeed of all sentient beings. Failure may be inevitable, but recognizing failure is the first step in becoming free. So I guess the first question I would ask is, does that have any real meaning to anyone? Bonnie, what does it mean? What to you?
You know, it's the mistakes that lead you to the discovery for me.
Mm-hmm.
And although it's also, sometimes we don't want to see the failure, there's a lot I can learn when I made a mistake, if I choose to look at it that way.
You make some meaning out of that. I didn't even think of it that way, because I was looking at the whole idea of the Bodhisattva ideal and the Bodhisattva vow. Does everyone know what that, at least a brief understanding of what the Bodhisattva ideal means? So let me explain it very briefly. But there's a different interpretation of the whole Bodhisattva ideal in every tradition. Every Mahayana tradition treats it a little bit differently, and sometimes very significantly differently. But the Bodhisattva vow is basically that I seek enlightenment, awakening, so that I can benefit all sentient beings, and I delay my own awakening until all sentient beings are awakened.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And so there's the paradox. And it's also something that the Buddha never taught. Because of that, my response back was, well, there's nothing in the Buddha's Dhamma that is confusing or paradoxical. And if it seems that way, you're probably going in a direction that is not part of the Dhamma. That doesn't mean that everything is clear when we first come across it. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the Bodhisattva ideal has become a cornerstone of a lot of modern Buddhism. And it sounds great, doesn't it? It sounds like a very wonderful altruistic direction to take in our lives. My life is about saving all sentient beings. But of course you have to acknowledge that it's impossible. So as wonderful as it sounds, why even waste the time considering it? And when we pursue it, it just leads to more confusion. So full disclosure, at one time I was involved in the Kagyu Tibetan Buddhism lineage. And over a weekend ceremony, I took my bodhisattva vows. I vowed to put aside my awakening until all sentient beings were awakened. And I also then took my vows of direct refuge, meaning stating my intention to become a Kagyu Tibetan practitioner, eventually leading to possibly monkhood. Obviously, I didn't do that. And I took it very seriously, and I was very happy when I did that. But as I pursued this idea, and now it was even stronger in my mind, that now my purpose is to save all sentient beings, I realized on a very subtle level how self-aggrandizing that can be. Not to everyone, but to me it did. And so now I had this purpose, I'm going to save everyone. And what I forgot during that purpose was, I need to save myself first.
It's like it counters meta.
Exactly. And it took a while for me to realize that, for me, the way I took it was a way of maintaining an ego point of view while still being engaged in so-called Buddhist practice. And I'm not saying that everyone that takes that vow is going to have the same experience, but I have noticed it often. That caused me to look at the whole idea a little bit deeper, the whole idea of modern Buddhism, or the whole teachings of modern Buddhism. And eventually I got to the point where I formally disavowed that, I renounced that vow, and I started looking for other understandings. So now that bodhisattva vow, I see it as just a confusing and paradoxical teachings, and I don't think it's helpful. Again, I'm not putting down any other lineage. I got a response from someone who read this article, and they were very upset at the position I took about bodhisattva and all that's claiming that I'm disparaging all other Buddhist lineages. And I'm not disparaging them, but there is quite a contradiction there. So that's that foundation for that.
I keep bouncing. Whenever I hear the bodhisattva vow, I keep then linking it to the last part of the metta. Did the bodhisattva vow come out of that?
No.
And what is the root of the metta thing anyhow? I can't find it in the in any of, so far I haven't found it in any of the Buddha's words.
Oh, the way that I present it is really my own interpretation of it, but I'll point it out to you where the Buddha goes through this process, beginning with ourselves, of developing goodwill and loving kindness for ourselves and then to all sentient beings. But expressing goodwill and loving kindness to all sentient beings is quite a bit different than stating for your life's purpose to put aside your own awakening until all sentient beings are awakened. And of course, it's an impossible task. Mm-hmm. And the explanation that's often given, in fact, this person that came back to me said that a lama, one of her teachers, said that, well, it doesn't really mean that, but what it does do is it starts inclining your heart to compassion. Great, but then if it doesn't really mean that, you need to stop saying it, you know, because it's just confusing. That's the point. That's the point of tonight's talk.
And it definitely goes in that order that you have to save the world and then awaken yourself. It's
most
not
of the
like
time.
At the same time, like, you know.
No, but and sometimes different traditions say that I seek awakening for myself so that I can save all sentient beings.
That makes at least a little more sense to
me. It does make a little bit more sense, but the creating that as the purpose for your Dhamma practice then becomes a little bit confusing and paradoxical. And it's something that the Buddha said is an intermediate step towards awakening. In other words, awakening and then taking on the process of developing awakening for all other people is a wrong view. It's based on a self-centered view. Simply seek awakening. And the process of an awake, or the involvement that awakened human being will have in the world will certainly have a rippling effect. But even the Buddha himself did not set himself up as a savior, even once awakened. He never set out to save the world. He did set out to bring awareness to the person that was in front of him. That's all. In that process, certainly there's an inclination to hope that the whole world hears these teachings and wakes up. But I know that I can't do anything about that. All that I can do is take care of who's in front of me.
And the question is whether he could be effective.
And awaken yourself. I mean, again, the Buddha keeps pointing back to forget about everything else. Wake up. We talked about this last week. Time is short. We don't know when the end is coming for any of us. Wake up. That's the point. Wake up. Don't get sidetracked or distracted by any other goal except individual awakening. So the Buddha offers... Let me read a little bit of this. And it's tied in with a specific sutta, the Satusasana Sutta. So, in the Satusasana Sutta, the Buddha is asked by Upali, then a follower of Nagantha Nataputta, who was nearly as famous as the Buddha and a contemporary of the Buddha in his teachings. So Upali was a follower of Nagantha Nataputta, and he asked the Buddha if the Buddha would give him a brief teaching of the Dhamma so that once he had heard it, he would, these are the words, dwell secluded, heedful, ardent, and resolute in his understanding. Meaning, can the Buddha present in a very concise way his entire teaching so that he can evaluate it and take to it? I'm getting ahead of myself. So Upali is asking how to determine a useful and effective teaching from a doctrine that would lead to more confusion. And so he's asking a way to compare it to Nagantha's teaching. The Buddha responded, "Be mindful of those qualities of mind and doctrines that do not lead to complete disenchantment or dispassion. Be mindful of those qualities of mind and doctrines that do not develop cessation and calm. Be mindful of those qualities of mind and doctrines that do not develop direct knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, or to self-awakening or to unbinding from self-referential views. When mindful in this manner, you will know this is not the Buddha's Dhamma, this is not his teachings." And this directly relates to how the Buddha presented mindfulness in relation to the Eightfold Path. He said, when in wrong view, be mindful of being in wrong view and enter and remain into right view. Be mindful when engaged in wrong intention and enter and remain into right intention. Very specific application of mindfulness. And he's teaching Upali the same thing. Upali, when you are mindful of the qualities of mind and the doctrine that develops complete disenchantment and dispassion, when you are mindful of the qualities of mind and the doctrine that develops cessation and calm, when you are mindful of the qualities of mind and the doctrine that develops direct knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and to self-awakening, to unbinding, then you will know this is the Buddha's Dhamma and this is the Buddha's teaching. Upali would become a monk in the Buddhist Sangha and awaken as a result of direct knowledge gained through wholehearted engagement with the Eightfold Path. Having understood the importance of discerning the Buddha's teachings and a useful method of distinguishing the Dhamma from other dharmas, he would become an arahant, an awakened human being. And Upali became very famous, or very important to Buddhism even today. And this is how. At the first Buddhist council, shortly after the Buddha's death, Upali, along with Ananda, would recall and recite the Buddha's teachings. Ananda recited the suttas or the doctrine, and Upali recited the Vinaya or the discipline. And so this established the Dhamma in a manner that continues in usefulness and authenticity today. The First Noble Truth describes the truth of suffering, which includes confusion and seeming paradox in the impermanent phenomenal world. Confusing and paradoxical dharmas arise by adapting and accommodating the Buddha's direct teachings to fit a confused and paradoxical doctrine. This confused doctrine is often then used to continue to establish a self-referential view in a self-referential Buddhism. This is understandable as it was, and this is an important point, and I'm pointing this out now just to be mindful that in a few paragraphs, I'm going to point out what the Buddha had to say about a bodhisattva way of life. This is understandable, as it was the initial confusion and seeming paradox of the world and the unsatisfactory nature of human life that caused Siddhartha Gautama to leave his life of luxury and spend six arduous years seeking understanding. He was seeking understanding of the confusion and paradox that is built into the world. Many of the spiritual practices he mastered during those 6 years he rejected precisely because they were confusing and paradoxical. The Buddha studied with the foremost spiritual teachers of his time, and for that very reason, that they were confusing and paradoxical, he said they weren't useful, and he abandoned them. The Buddha awakened to the cause of all human unsatisfactoriness, ignorance. This is a very specific ignorance. Dependent origination teaches very clearly that from ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, through 12 observable and causative links, the unsatisfactory nature of life follows. He presented his first teaching as these Four Noble Truths. He would spend the next 45 years teaching, always in the context of developing understanding of these truths. Developing the Buddha's Eightfold Path does take right effort. A consistent shamatha vipassana meditation practice, developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path, brings lasting peace and happiness. Engaging wholeheartedly with the Eightfold Path does not begin with acknowledging the confusing and paradoxical nature of the teachings, but with the understanding that through direct inquiry, through the original teachings of the Buddha, that will bring understanding and release. So if a teaching presented as Buddhism seems confusing or paradoxical, the lesson the Buddha presented to a Pali is useful. Does the teaching hold the possibility of developing understanding of the Four Noble Truths? Will it develop cessation of self-referential views, or does it further establish self-referential views? Remember that every teaching the Buddha presented was to develop understanding of the generally unsatisfactory nature of life that is caused by craving, and to continue to establish an ego personality and clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas that maintain the confusing and paradoxical nature of an ego self. I probably should have split that into two sentences. Every teaching the Buddha presented was presented in the context of the Four Noble Truths. So the point of all this that I'm talking about tonight is as we can develop discernment of what teachings may be useful in developing awakening by simply seeing if they fit into this context of the Four Noble Truths and developing the cessation of craving and clinging. If the teaching seeks to establish a self in any form, in any realm, at any point, then it's not part of the Dhamma, because the whole point of the Dhamma is to recognize self-referential viewpoints and abandon them. There's no value then in establishing a self in some different realm or in some type of ideal as a savior to the world, something the Buddha himself disavowed. There was one part I wanted to read now that I said I would. The Buddha consistently talked about himself in the past as an unawakened bodhisattva. And he did that, I think, for a very specific reason, to point out that you can have the heart of a bodhisattva but still be confused about what your purpose and role is in the life, in this life. The Buddha often said, as an unawakened bodhisattva, I had the thought that renunciation and seclusion is good, but being an unawakened bodhisattva, my heart did not leap at renunciation. He wasn't inspired by the idea of awakening because he was still stuck in an ego personality or trying to defend that. I did not grow confident or steadfast in the Dhamma. I did not see renunciation as bringing peace. He saw a loss in renouncing worldly things. Then the thought occurred to me that I have yet to understand the drawback of self-indulgence through sensual pleasures. I have yet to understand the reward of renunciation. That is why my heart does not engage fully with the path and with renunciation. He was still distracted by the idea of being a bodhisattva. It's a very, very high ideal. There's nothing wrong with it, except ultimately it will prove to be a distraction to awakening. So then the Buddha concludes this. Then the thought occurred to me, if having understood the drawback of sensual pleasures leading to distraction and suffering, not understanding right view, developing right view, I pursued the path, my heart would leap at renunciation and I would develop freedom, release, and lasting peace and happiness. Having understand even that high ideal, is a view rooted in a form of self-centeredness or self-indulgence. I'm going to save the world. You know? Instead of taking to the simple and direct matter of awakening without any other distraction, we don't awaken for any other reason, except it's really the only thing to do, isn't it? There's not even any real altruistic reason attached to awakening, except it's the most sensible thing we can do. And the result of that is the possibility that humanity may be saved. But that's not the goal. As one individual wakes up, other people awaken. The Buddha proved that by simply... The Buddha awakened, and very quickly, the dominoes started to fall, meaning that other people very quickly started awakening as a result of his influence as an awakened human being. But first he had to awaken. Another way to look at this, when the Buddha was born in a very strong social and political position as a prince to the king's throne. One day he would be king. If he was only concerned about doing social good and effecting social change, he would have stayed right there because he was in a much more powerful position to do it quickly, but not nearly as effectively as an awakened human being. So he left that behind, that position of power and influence, to develop his own awakening, to awaken himself. And in the process, he then left a path for us all to awaken. If he remained as a king, or remained as a prince and ascended to the throne, we probably never would have heard of Siddhartha Gautama at all. He would have led a significant life to his time, but a completely insignificant life to human history. So that's the talk. So any questions about that or comments?
Okay,
please, Mary Beth.
How did you make your way from, you know, you said you had renounced those vows?
How did I?
Went searching further.
That's a great question. It's because of many years of wholehearted engagement with the Dharma as it was presented to me. I realized that I was just more confused and more stuck in paradoxy than I ever was before. And I also, maybe this is a little bit of intuition, but I could not believe at that point that a human being that had awakened would leave such a confusing path. It just didn't add up to me anymore. And that's when I started questioning, for the first time in my life, what was being presented.
But then you stepped away from that. So you renounced those views. I'm just curious, like, then what did you do?
I went from a strong follower of the Tibetan lineage that I was in, and Tibetan Buddhism in general,
mm-hmm.
Thinking that, well, it's got to be in Zen. It must be in Zen because that's the simple, direct way. That cuts aside all the... and this is when I met this man, actually. I started doing some... meaning the man that made that quote. I got deeply involved in the Zen tradition, which, you know, it's incredible. I had a great time with those folks. many, many long sesshins that I did, 7 and 10 day silent meditations, and a lot of time meditating in a group with a certain monastery, and listening to their teachings and the structure of their practice. Always, the whole time I was involved in Zen, again, I'm not putting it down, this is my experience, always with an uncomfortable edge. To me, it just felt like from the beginning, something's not quite right here, but I put it on myself. That's just my own lack of understanding it because I don't see something clearly. Eventually, I got to the same point where I was just more confused and more frustrated than I was, you know, in my 20s. And that's when I decided that there's got to be a way of finding out what the Buddha actually taught because I didn't believe it was either one of these things. I thought that maybe he inspired these teachings, but I didn't think this could possibly be a teaching of an awakened human being. And that's when I started looking at the Pali Canon, which I always knew was the preserved teachings of the Buddha, but I always thought that everything else was built on that, so no real need to look at it. But it was once I started doing that things started falling into place.
And actually just reading it and studying it with other people? Or?
Mostly on my own, but then I had a few people that I could contact. I'll just mention one because the other two kind of asked, it probably wouldn't be right. One of them was Thanissara Bhikkhu, who's out in the West Coast now. And he was very helpful in guiding me through some of my frustrations and pointing me in the right direction. But he said, you know, if you really want to understand this, you just got to go after it. And it took quite a few, it took a lot of effort because the Pali Canon is written in a very, a very repetitive, old-fashioned, and somewhat discursive way until I finally realized through the consistency that's in the Pali Canon that everything the Buddha taught was in relation to the Four Noble Truths. And when I had that realization, then everything started making sense. Because then I wasn't looking for mystical or esoteric answers to anything. It was just this practical application of the Four Noble Truths. And that deepened my practice. It made meditation make sense instead of just sitting. And it gave me a structure for my life that I could integrate, meaning the Eightfold Path. And then I started seeing real results. So, sorry for the long answer, but that's where it led me. Yeah, and I guess that's why I teach what I teach. You know, it doesn't come from a distaste for anything Tibetan or anything Oriental. It comes from having a direct experience that, for me, it wasn't helpful. And the using the method and the framework that the Buddha taught to Upali, when I applied it, it made all the difference in the world. Does it relate? Does it relate to what the Buddha's intention was? I came across a quote once that knocked me off my cushion. The Buddha said, I teach the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. And I think, man, I've been spending 20 years of my life trying to figure all this out, and that's all there is to it. But that's all there is to it. But again, it's as Ron was saying a little earlier, we had a talk before class started, there's many, many layers of that suffering. There's many, many layers of the understanding. But even then, that these multi-layered conditioned minds that we all have, in the end, are nothing. The mind, the confused mind is really nothing, except that right now, while we're unawakened, it has us in its grip. And so how do you get out of a confused, paradoxical mind state? You certainly don't chase confused, paradoxical teachings. You need something simple. I think the Buddha realized this, and so he presented as simple a Dhamma as is possible and still be useful. He taught a way so that we could avoid being distracted by our own desire to awaken and keep ourselves focused on the goal at hand, putting aside all self-referential views. He didn't allow anything in the Dhamma that could anyway continue a self-referential or confused view.
So do you call that like pure Buddhism or something? And do other people teach it like you do, or did you just...
Oh, yeah, and the... How do I answer this question? A lot of people that take objection to the way I teach, and there's well, maybe I shouldn't say a lot. There's a few. They always accuse me of being a Theravadan, which I'm not. Or
what?
Theravadan. Theravada is the modern branch of Buddhism that's as close as possible, in their view, to the Buddha's original teachings. I would not call myself a Theravadan Buddhist any more than I would call myself any other type of Buddhist. I'm simply somebody who has developed understanding through the Four Noble Truths.
Why did you not call yourself a Theravadan?
Well, for one thing, I don't know about classifying myself in any way is useful. To me, it's just creating another view.
Right.
I understand if you're going to join as a monk or a nun and be part of an organization, well, there you are. You know, you're a Theravadan. There are some aspects of... Theravadan means the teaching of the elders. So it kind of points back to the original teachings. But there's some practices that they've developed that I don't completely agree with and I don't think are necessary. So, and it's more in that I don't think they're necessary that I don't agree with them. Why do something that's not going to lead directly to awakening? You know, to me, a Dhamma practice, and we all experience this, is something that, at least initially, we have to fit into our lives. So we don't need extraneous stuff attached to it that make it even more difficult to develop. I think especially as Westerners, and certainly as busy human beings in the modern world, we need a way to get at it, rather simply and directly, don't we? We don't have time to sift through a lot of distracting things. And when you read the Pali Canon, when you read what the Buddha taught, everything points back to these simple practices in developing awakening through the Eightfold Path. I've never come across a sutta that in some way did not relate back to that first teaching of the Four Noble Truths and understanding dependent origination. And that's, again, so a great question. That's when it really made sense to me, and that's why I teach what I teach. I couldn't put a number on it. There are other teachers that teach this. Again, Theravadan teachers tend to be more focused in this way on the original teachings of the Buddha, but not all of them. Bhikkhu Bodhi has written some great books that speak to the original teachings of the Buddha, but he also gets into other teachings that I don't think are helpful. I think they're confusing. Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote a long discourse about how the Buddha never really meant that I teach suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. But if you, again, yeah. But I think that he was appealing, getting into something. I think he was trying to appeal and calm down people that were taking objection to that. But I don't think that it's, to me, right speech is speech that is not confusing and paradoxical and doesn't point people in a direction that is unhelpful to them. I think when you're speaking about the Dhamma, for one thing, I think you should know what you're talking about, and you should be willing to keep it on the Dhamma. It doesn't help anybody in this room if I start telling you what I think the Dhamma should be. You know, and I hope I don't do that. I mean, I'm pretty careful that I speak only what I know from what I've learned through the Pali Canon, because I think that's the Dhamma. So I think the most egregious thing anybody can do is to mislead people as far as the Dhamma is concerned. I'm not putting anybody else down. This is from my point of view. I couldn't imagine myself doing it. Other people teach the Dhamma from a very, very... I don't think I've ever met an insincere teacher of Buddhism in general. I've yet to meet that person. Even though they may be teaching a Dhamma that I don't agree with. You know? For someone to spend their life teaching something that they feel is of benefit to all human beings, and the life you have to live to do that, it takes a level of commitment and sincerity. So again, I'm not putting down any individual, especially this old friend of mine. But there's the Dhamma and this other thing. Gail, did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Thank you for the question. Any other questions, comments, feelings?
I have one comment.
Please.
It goes back to what you were talking about as it refers to first waking up yourself. And I know that I've had that thought. I wouldn't say I've been conflicted about it, but I've had the thought of, I don't want to say selfishness because it's not the right word, but, you know, you have to take care of yourself first, and in doing that, you kind of have to put aside some other things that are outside of you so that you can spend the time and the energy with the right intention to try to wake up. And sometimes as I have that thought, it's relieving, and then I feel guilty at the same time.
Yeah.
But I just continue to refer back to the teachings to reinforce that it's okay to feel that way, because the most important thing to do is to wake up, and then that will take care of everything else.
It will.
So, just a common thing.
Yeah, thank you. I often say here, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all humanity is to get to it. Wake up. Stop being a conveyor of confusion and suffering. Confusion, delusion, and suffering is experienced by individuals, and it's described universally as the First Noble Truth. There is suffering. But so for that suffering to end universally, it has to begin at the cause, which is individual confusion and delusion. And so once an individual awakens, then you can live the life of a Buddha if you want. You can spend the next 45 years of your life effectively bringing social change and individual awakening. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't be altruistic and caring and compassionate in our daily lives prior to our own awakening. That's just being a good and responsible human being. But to not lose sight in compassionate and altruistic acts to such an extent that we lose our path, we lose the Eightfold Path.
Well, I find for myself, too, it's been helpful in that what I tend to do is to take on other individuals' struggles, to try to be helpful in some way and to maybe be empathetic or what have you. And I found that I would just get sucked in, and then it would take my attention away from really focusing on myself and trying to eliminate that stress, which ultimately will help that person in a different way. So I feel like that's been something that has been helpful for me to realize, and at first hard, because I want to be that empathetic voice, and I think you can still help without taking on that person's stress. Sometimes you just have to step back and say, that's kind of their thing that they need to work through, and I can only do so much.
Yeah, and that thing that they have to work through is described in the First Noble Truth. There is suffering in the world. There's always going to be. There's always going to be an unsatisfactory nature to living in the world. There's nothing anybody can do. Even the Buddha can't do anything about that. First Noble Truth. That's why it's a noble truth. But what we can do is to awaken ourselves and understand an aspect of clinging is becoming entangled in the world and in other people's lives. That doesn't mean that we should live lives of hermits, but also to wisdom allows us to be involved with other people without getting deeply entangled in their lives and losing our own way in that. That's an important aspect of this, and it's an important aspect of understanding a simpler level of the Bodhisattva vow. Is the human beings need to be helpful to other people. But oftentimes, I think we've all experienced that, in our desire to be helpful to someone, we might have stepped on people's toes or made them upset in our endeavors.
Or confused them more.
And again, that can arise in Buddhism as someone who sees themselves as a bodhisattva, but just in normal human life, we've done that. And again, it's not we're doing something wrong, but it's because we're lacking true wisdom to know when to act and how to act.
Thich Nhat Hanh writes about intention, and your intention may be this big umbrella of helping, but if you don't have the understanding of what the need is, your intention can be off target and not, you won't satisfy the need.
Yeah, and it can actually lead to more suffering.
Absolutely.
It happens all the time. Yeah. And, you know, we could get into a whole long discussion about social intervention policies and where some have gone and where, I mean, some are good, some are bad, but it's just to make the point. The most important thing, there's going to be an unsatisfactory nature. There's going to be a suffering. There's going to be suffering in the world. There always will be. The most effective thing we can do about worldly suffering is to end it for ourselves. In that process of developing understanding of our own suffering, we develop a deeper understanding of the cause of other people's suffering. And that wisdom can truly inform useful social interaction. But first we have to be free of our own clinging.
And that's right on with what I was saying, too. For me, the way I interpret that is I would try to take the pain away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And that's not helping that person. They're not experiencing it. They're not understanding a way to approach it in a more healthy way to be able to grow as a person. I'm just trying to take it away. I'm taking on that stress.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not allowing them to really act how they need to act.
Yeah. And so what's the most mindful response? Is to let somebody know that you're present in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Period. I mean, practical things. Somebody needs a bowl of soup, you give them a bowl of soup. But what I mean is that as we develop a deeper mindfulness of who we are and the own process of our life unfolding and moving towards awakening, then we can be present for other people. And that's really what people need. The most devastating thing, I think, and I'll put it in this... in the category of an emotional hurt rather than slugging somebody in the nose. The most hurtful thing we can do to any human being, especially to a child, but any human being, is to ignore them, to turn your back on them. In some societies, the biggest insult you can give them is to turn your back on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of that. And so what's the opposite of ignoring someone? It's having the wisdom to be fully present with them. But we can't do that if we're distracted by continuing to establish our own ego personality. We need to be free of it. Then we can sit and be present. The reason why just sitting in a group quietly, forget about meditating, is so astonishing to me is just that. When we're doing that, we're just being fully present with each other. Again, that's one of the most astonishing things in my life, that we're able to do that, to just sit quietly and be present with each other. We don't have to continue to establish ourselves by conversation or by position. We can just be, you know. And again, I guess I got a little bit off the talk tonight. But, the point is that we have a way to put aside all the behaviors and conditioned thinking that leads to an unsatisfactory nature of life, and to not be present in our own life, and directly wake up and develop that pure mindfulness of who and what we are as life occurs. And we can be bodhisattvas too. any other questions or comments? Really good. We'll go around the room again later. We'll have a little time, I think. So let's meditate. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Keeping your back straight, but not stiff. Ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies. And settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just be aware of what that's like, to be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you notice that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. We'll meditate for 20 minutes. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.